Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Vincent Cunningham, and I'm filling in today for David Remnick. Today I'm going to be talking about something very near and dear to my heart, which is the pleasure, especially in the summer, of stepping away from your device, from your phone, and indulging in the pleasure of reading. We're going to be hearing today from several of my colleagues at The New Yorker, but we wanted to start here at the beach because, really, what better place to open up a book? Yeah, Brighton Beach is basically the southernmost point of Brooklyn. Unlike many other beaches in New York, which feel very like destination-y, this feels like it's like a neighborhood beach where like somebody who lives two blocks away would come here to take a dip and then go back home. And there are people out having a great time, some in the water, some with their coolers, some hopefully with some books. Oh, there's a book. Sir, I'm so sorry to startle you.
Yeah.
Can I ask you what you're reading? Is it?
I'm reading Mananga by David McAteer. I'm not sure if I pronounced his name correctly, but it's a history of the Mananga mine explosion in West Virginia in 1907, which was the worst workplace disaster in American history.
So light reading then, you would say?
I guess not.
Thank you so much for letting us intrude for a bit. As a kid, used to watch Looney Tunes. It's Elmer Fudd, you know. I'm hunting wabbits. I feel like I'm hunting books right now.
My name is Juliet. I'm 11. I'm reading Restart. It's for summer reading for school.
For school.
And it's about this boy who fell off a roof and then he lost his memory.
Uh-huh.
And he's trying to like restart his life.
So when you're reading for summer reading, it means it's like a little bit like homework. Is it easier to do that when you're on the beach like this? It's kind of a nice thing to do.
I mean, yeah, my school starts in like a week because it starts a bit earlier than last time. But it starts in a week and I have to do this for a reading. It usually takes me about a week to finish.
And what other kinds of books do you like to read?
I like Wonder. Wonder is about a boy named August and he has this like face disorder. And he's been homeschooled his whole life, so he's going into a real school. He's making new friends. I really like that book. I reread it a lot of times, like four, I think.
That's how I read when I was your age, just rereading and rereading the same books over and over.
Yeah, because every time you reread it, you find something new in it.
Yeah.
Like you see it in a different way every time you read it.
Thank you so much for sharing with us.
You're welcome.
We appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Have a good day.
Have a great rest of your day. And good luck at school.
Thank you.
Are you doing beach reading? Is this a Kindle with a book on it?
Mm-hmm.
Amazing. Would you mind if we interrupt your like very peaceful looking moment here and just ask you what it is that you're reading?
Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows.
Is that's number five, the Deathly Hallows?
Last book, number seven.
Last one.
Mm-hmm.
Is this your first time reading Harry Potter?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm not gonna say anything about that.
I think she knows what happens.
Yeah.
No, I know what happens, don't worry.
Okay. Can you tell us the name of the book that you're reading and just why you're reading it? What's
yeah. I'm reading the autobiography of Malcolm X. Why I'm reading it? I am from Egypt, born and raised. So I never been exposed to the American culture, never been impressed by it. And as a like, I'm working on my first documentary, and I'm interested in filmmaking and trying to understand humans in general. So for me, knowing and trying to know about Malcolm X, he's definitely one of the most influential. Like he influenced the modern history of black community. It's just he's a very interesting person with a very complex arc that for me, like, it's time for me to study. Like, shame on me that I'm going towards my 30s and I don't know what I need really to know about him.
Thank you. That's, I really appreciate it.
It was nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you. We are, I want to say, a half a mile up the beach. Now we're up, that could be my sort of dramatic side kicking it. But we are now approaching Coney Island. You can see the roller coasters going. You can see the iconic letters of the cyclone and the people going up and down on that. You know that thing that terrifyingly goes up and down? I don't know the name of it.
Hi, should I say? Hi, my name is Susana.
And my name is Sophia.
That's my mommy.
She just came to America a year ago.
I would love it. And you're already laughing. So I would just love it if you could tell me what you're eating.
Because this reading is awful.
Oh my God,
absolutely,
this is
awful.
Embarrassing.
It's very,
it's not primitive, no reading is embarrassing.
Primitive Russian detective story.
Oh, cool.
It's not decent to read such books.
This is what we call beach reading. It's light reading. It's not the,
yeah, okay,
the most scholarly text.
I like this.
And what's the, just very briefly, what is the plot? What happens in the book?
A woman wakes up and finds that she doesn't remember anything. She has lost her memory, and then from that place the story unfolds. Oh, I know this word, unfolds. Ah, but as far as I understand, although I'm in the middle of the book, the idea is that the gangsters and I'm sorry, the Russian police work in one team. They're always connected. Yeah,
Russian police.
So, yeah, the life is difficult in Russia. Thank you.
This has been so great. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
We appreciate it. And enjoy the rest of the book. Brighton Beach, where I talk to these folks, is a bus ride from where I live. But recently I took a real vacation. It felt decadent. We went for 2 weeks, which made it the longest vacation I've ever taken. So I've been thinking a lot about how being away from home can change not just what you read, but also how you read it. So for example, on this vacation, my wife and one of my best friends and I went to the town of Oak Bluffs in Martha's Vineyard, a famous place of resort for black people. I don't know about anybody else, but I like on vacation, I always bring like these books with you, these other books that you think, you know, you bring a library that's like, and these are the sort of things that I'm going to, you know, dutifully read. And it never happens, right? You spend all day outside, and when you get home, you're too tired. When you're on the beach, you nap instead of read, and you sort of let this like feeling of guilt happen to you. What ended up happening really is that I got dragged, you know, step by step into the news. I read a bunch of articles about Andrew Cuomo. I let politics intrude on my vacation. I read a bunch about Barack Obama, who was on the island having his ill-fated birthday party at the same time that I was there. But really, the sort of thing that I keep thinking about over and over was a book that I found on a shelf of the house that I was staying on. So this house that I rented was first bought in the 70s by a very famous black doctor and public health innovator. There was a very small shelf of books that seemed to speak to like the class of people that vacation over the summer in Martha's Vineyard. There was a book called Negroland by Margot Jefferson, who's one of my favorite critics, and she's talking about the black upper classes. Also on that shelf was a book called
Our Kind of People by Lawrence Otis Graham. I'd known of this book for a long time, and I'd known of Graham, who incidentally died last year, but I'd never read it. I picked it up off the shelf and sat down on the couch and started to read. Our Kind of People is about the Black elite in America. These old line Black families, fraternal organizations, sororities, social clubs like Jack and Jill, and about vacation resorts like Martha's Vineyard. And so in a way, I found myself strangely reading about the vacation I was having, or at least reading about the historical processes and accidents that led to the vacation that I was having. He talks in the book about being a kid and spending his entire summers there. He comes from this fairly wealthy Black family. He says, for 3 months each year, the three-block stretch of stores on Circuit Avenue and the short strip of sand along Seaview Avenue, which we Blacks call the Inkwell, was the center of our universe. So I would carry lines like that around me as I, in fact, walked down Circuit Avenue and walked along Seaview Avenue. When I swam in the Inkwell, I had in mind the history of the Inkwell as narrated by this person. And I'll be honest, like, at some points, I was very off-put by this book because it's like really self-consciously about an elite to which I do not belong. These sort of secret processes, especially with, you know, through fraternities and social organizations, that sort of winnow a kind of elite away from the working classes to which I feel that I've always belonged, right? So there's a moment where it almost showed me that maybe 40 years ago, I wouldn't have belonged in this place. I didn't grow up with money. My family didn't own any land, right? And so reading this reconnected me to that part of my history. But also, I write for the New Yorker magazine, and I too was on a vacation in Martha's Vineyard. And so walking the streets that were mentioned in the book, it felt like trying on your big brother's pants and finding that, like, in some ways they fit, in some ways they don't. But like the sort of bagginess of those pants, right? The places where they don't fit is exactly the pleasurable sort of dissonance of reading. This was, I guess, a way to indulge in my kind of vacation, which is like walking around thinking about why I'm there, like what forces propelled me to meet this place. And especially in a place like Martha's Vineyard, which has got so many historical ties to Black upward mobility and the forces of segregation making Black people vacation in one place rather than another. And so it was a strange thing. I tend to take my reading as this kind of almost a cult practice. When something in my reading corresponds with what's going on in my life, I sort of just like tend to run into those little moments of confluence and take them as a kind of magic or an offering or something like that. That sense that reading is a kind of doubling of life, that you're living twice, and that all the correspondences between those two tracks in your life made life richer and more dense with meaning. I'm Vincent Cunningham, sitting in for David Remnick today. In a minute, the great environmental writer Bill McKibben is going to tell me about what he's been reading. That's just ahead on the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from the New Yorker. This episode of New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by ZBiotics. We all have busy lives these days and can't afford to waste a day on the couch because of a few drinks the night before. Luckily, a new product, ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic, is here to help. ZBiotics breaks down the byproduct of alcohol responsible for those rough mornings. Try it today by going to zbiotics.com/radiohour and get 15% off your first order when you use Radio Hour at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with 100% money-back guarantee, So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund your money. That's zbiotics.com/radiohour and use the code radiohour at checkout for 15% off.
Carnegie Hall is one of the most famous concert venues in the world.
The first time I walked on the stage, I felt like my feet were moving, but they were not touching the floor.
Join us for If This Hall Could Talk, a new podcast that explores the history of this iconic landmark through the unique items in its archives. I'm your host, Jessica Vosk, and together we'll explore how the past shaped the culture we live in today. Listen to If This Hall Could Talk wherever you get podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Vincent Cunningham. We're talking today about the joys of reading, particularly during the summer months.
I don't tend to go to the beach, I gotta say. I live out in the woods all year round. So I think, if anything, I may be the exception to the rule. I read a little bit less in the summer because as the light lingers in the day, I tend to be out in enjoying the woods. My reading gets done most in the winter because when it gets dark at 4:30 in the afternoon, you just curl up by the stove and there you are.
Bill McKibben here is a New Yorker contributor and also the founder of the environmental organization 350.org. And he is himself one of the great living writers on the natural world. So he's really immersed in that literature. So, Bill, a book you told us really grabbed you was a book called The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. Who is Kim Stanley Robinson? Tell me about him.
I've been reading his work for a very long time. He's usually defined as a science fiction writer, and indeed his first important books, trilogy that won every award that science fiction has to offer, took place on Mars. But even then, truthfully, Vincent, they were less science fiction than kind of political science fiction. They're about how humans would settle a place and what the politics of that would be like and how it would be negotiated. And I've admired his work for so many years because he's a humanist in the deepest sense, and he's also just great fun to read. Mm. In many ways reminds me of Mark Twain in terms of being both in terms of being funny and in terms of being very much about what the psychology of our country and our world is about right now.
So the new book is about climate change, but maybe not the straight up apocalyptic version. What drew you to it?
Well, what drew me most of all was not the thing that most people have noted, which is the very scary opening scene where an enormous heat wave smacks India, but more the long, long, long list of ingredients in the recipe for our salvation, a kind of drawing from every possible source, science, economics, nonviolent movement building, maybe a little bit of dark arts thrown in there, all of which combine to offer, if not salvation, then at least a plausible route out, which seems to me as much as one could possibly ask for at the moment.
You got the chance to sit down with Kim Stanley Robinson last week.
Indeed I did, and what a pleasure. Let's start with a little reading. Your newest book, Ministry for the Future, starts with a heat wave in Uttar Pradesh in India. And let's hear a bit of your description of that event, which we see through the eyes of an American aid worker named Frank.
Okay, I'll start. This is very near the first pages of the book. Everything was tan and beige and a brilliant, unbearable white. Ordinary town in Uttar Pradesh, 6 a.m. He looked at his phone, 38 degrees. In Fahrenheit, that was, he tapped, 103 degrees. Humidity, about 35%. The combination was the thing. A few years ago, it would have been among the hottest wet bulb temperatures ever recorded. Now, just a Wednesday morning. Wails of dismay cut the air, coming from the rooftop across the street. Cries of distress, a pair of young women leaning over the wall, calling down to the street. Someone on that roof was not waking up. Frank tapped at his phone and called the police. No answer. He couldn't tell if the call had gone through or not. Sirens now cut the air, sounding distant, as if somehow submerged. With the dawn, people were discovering sleepers in distress, finding those who would never wake up from that long, hot night, calling for help. The sirens seemed to indicate some of the calls had worked. Frank checked his phone again. It was charged, showed a connection, but no reply at the police station he had had occasion to call a few times in his 4 months here. 2 months to go. 58 days, way too long. July 12th, monsoon not yet arrived. Focus on getting through today, one day at a time. Then home to Jacksonville, comically cool after this. He would have stories to tell, but the poor people on the rooftop across the way.
Stan, it feels like you're barely a beat ahead of the news here. This book's a year old now. And in the meantime, we've seen the highest temperature ever recorded in Europe, the highest temperature we think in Canada since the Pleistocene. We've had the hottest year on record across the globe. Does it feel like you're just barely out in the world of science fiction?
Yeah, it sure does. But, you know, I wasn't really, I mean, I am a science fiction writer, and the near future is an interesting zone to try to write. It always is. But this one was really an easy call to make. There was an argument between mitigation and adaptation, and some people were saying, look, we can't possibly stop climate change, so we just have to adapt to it, and humans are adaptable. But they're wrong about this one thing. We can't adapt to high heat and humidity in combination. It simply kills humans from hyperthermia. The course that we're on now in the rise of temperature and the latest IPCC report indicates where we're at is such that big swaths of the Earth's surface could become uninhabitable for weeks at a time. It'll come and go. The weather is so variable. When I wrote, I was writing about a present danger. It was not like 50 years out. It could happen now. In Pakistan and United Arab Emirates, there had been brief moments of wet bulb 35. And if that lasted for 24 hours, it would have been a catastrophe. So we're right there, yes.
Well, part of what's interesting about that, and you just referenced this most recent IPCC report, which was, you know, in many ways a kind of medical readout of the planet's future as if we were a patient. And yet it passed within a few hours in the news stream that we were in, and pretty soon we were on to a dozen other things. One of the things that happens in Ministry of Future is that the heat wave in India seems to be a large enough event that it finally starts to shake the system a little bit by the neck. Is that how it's going to be, do you think? Will there be finally some trigger that really does that, or is it going to be a slow accretion of these events one after another?
I would reckon a slow accretion, but the danger of a really big catastrophe is there. And could happen. And that will not change the world. The rest of the world will say, ah, well, India's hot, or Indonesia's hot, or Alabama's hot. And they'll say, it can't happen to me. This is a very common human response. So even in my novel, I wanted to portray a best case scenario for the next 30 years of how, if we did things right, we might come to a place that the people who living then liked. So after my postulated weather extreme heat disaster, I had the Paris Agreement meet at a COP meeting and decide that they were not keeping up with the pace of catastrophes, and set up a standing committee to study it. And it gets the informal name of the Ministry for the Future, which is to represent the people of the future in current legal situations and political situations. And what they do from that ministry is try all over the world to cooperate and coordinate with any project that's doing good things and forward the good. And of course, there's resistance, and there I have my plot. I don't think there's any one trigger that'll make us respond well. We're going to have to educate ourselves and fight for it every little step of the way, I think.
Even after 20 million people die in a heat wave in India, people are still taking vacations, having governments, you know, making a living, having festivals, making music. There's something about that that seems to me to inform this book and many of your books, that sense of people figuring out how to cope in one way or another with the world that we're sliding into.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, I do that, and that's a good story to tell because of the post-apocalyptic zombie imaginary in our culture that after us, the deluge, and those poor people will be eating their pets and eating each other, and oh gosh, we're better off than they are. That whole dystopian post-apocalyptic strain, it doesn't serve as a warning. It doesn't make you change your behavior. You don't worry that the dead are going to come charging out of the graves in the real world. So I reject all that. And I write as a utopian science fiction writer, which at the moment we're at right now in world history means that I have to set a pretty low bar for utopia. If we dodge a mass extinction event in this century, that's utopian writing. That's the best we can expect from where we are right now. And having put that story on the table as being possible, it suggests that we ought to be trying for it. So this is the purpose of taking that tack of talking about, okay, life goes on, so let's make it better rather than letting it get worse.
One of the things that marks Ministry for the Future is this willingness to throw everything and the kitchen sink at this problem without much regard for ideology or anything else. You clearly have always identified as a leftist. You're openly critical of capitalism. On the other hand, you know, the central banks and their manipulation of currency plays a huge role in the outcome here.
Yeah. This is not my own idea. I found it in the literature. There's a paper by Delton Chen, but this is also kind of becoming widespread. Quantitative easing, there's a new phrase, carbon quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, we saw in 2008, and the economy was crashing. The Fed pumped a whole bunch of money into the economy. We didn't get inflation, and the wheels of our economic life were greased, and everything went on. It's worked. Now, the trick of the carbon quantitative easing is the central banks simply make up that money and give it first to decarbonization projects of all kinds, from individuals to cities to regions to nation states, but always for decarbonization. Well, what I found out after Ministry for the Future came out is that there is an organization called the Network for Greening the Financial System. It's 89 of the biggest central banks on Earth. This network, they have all gotten together to discuss carbon quantitative easing. They are, in effect, inventing the carbon coin that is in my novel. And it's one of several things that's happened since my novel came out that made me realize that, in some ways, I was behind the curve in Ministry for the Future, that things are going faster than you can keep up with in your mental space. And I found it very encouraging because we need these things, and there's a general tendency over social media to doom and despair, and we cannot give in to doom. We have to actually look at all of the good work that's already being done.
It strikes me that you've been, throughout your career, writing about the ways that groups of people try to solve their problems. We've come through this long period in your lifetime and mine, where we went through what strikes me as a kind of hyper-individualism. Do you think that circumstances are kind of dragging us out of that now and back towards some era where solidarity is more of a possibility?
Well, maybe. I would say this. The solidarity is not going to be a kumbaya, all peoples getting on board with this. We're not constituted that way. It'll be a political battle of enormous proportions. I'd say we're on a fence, a slippery, a dangerous moment where the possibility of gathering a working political majority that can steamroll the regressive reactionary forces that would drag us down to destruction is there to be had. If it fell apart into nationalism, tribalism, and everybody out for themselves, then it really could fall apart quite badly. But the potential for coming together and saying, look, we're all on this one planet, and we don't have any other planets. As one of the principal living Martians of this time, I will say Mars is just about as important as Antarctica, which is to say Not much.
Antarctica may be pretty important if it melts, I gotta say.
Oh, yes. There's no doubt about that. We need to keep that ice up there on that ice cap, or else the coasts of the world are in terrible trouble.
Let's end this close to your home and close to your heart. If I'm correct, you've been spending a lot of time up in the High Sierra and writing about hiking and that incredible terrain. But it must be, there's a little bit of a busman's holiday aspect to it, because too often now when we wander the backcountry of Tuolumne or whatever it is, we're looking up in the sky and seeing the smoke from wildfires. How are you thinking about the range of light, as Muir called it once these days?
Well, it's very hard. I just got back, so I'm a little overwhelmed. I haven't yet taken it on. It was hazy. That happens in the summer. It's right next to the Central Valley. It wasn't exceptionally smoky. I've hiked in that too. But the glaciers are gone. The Sierra had 100 glaciers, and I was in Dead Man Canyon in the Sequoia National Park this last week, and the head wall of Dead Man Canyon is a perfect amphitheater, like a half bowl dropping into a slot of a funnel. It's north-facing, so at the very top of this bowl, there are 8 glaciers on the map, and the 8 on the map are all gone except for the final fragment of a middle one, which was the biggest and also had the most shade during the day. I hiked up to it. I hacked off some ice for my scotch. I kissed it goodbye. It's going to be gone in 3 years or less. All night long it was running, like when your toilet flap hasn't gone down. That sound ran all night long because it didn't get even close to freezing. It was probably 45 degrees at night. But all the stream beds were dry. They were utterly dry. And I mean rivers that you would have had to go knee-deep to cross, or meadow oxbows that were 20 feet across and 10 feet deep, dry as a bone everywhere. Only the lakes had water. This is just one winter of drought, a bad snow, and it was the driest part of the Sierra typically. I'm going to go up again and see what it's like further north next week. But I tell you, it was shocking and devastating.
Well, I completely hear you. And I think all of us who love particular places in the natural world and are watching them change have a lot of that. And let me just say, in the deepest sense, thank you enormously for being willing to look all that square in the face and bring us the story over and over and over again. We're very, very much in your debt in all sorts of ways for that. And thank you enormously, Stan.
Thank you.
Kim Stanley Robinson's book, The Ministry for the Future, came out last year. You can read Bill McKibben's writing on climate and the environment at newyorker.com. I'm Vincent Cunningham, sitting in today for David Remnick. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm Vincent Cunningham, sitting in for David Remnick. We've been talking today about summer reading, and if you don't have a good book to dig into, let me recommend a story that just published in the New Yorker. It's called The Mom of Bold Action. It's by George Saunders, who's one of the truly great short story writers working now. The mom in the title, The Mom of Bold Action, is dealing with an incident, her son was roughed up on the street, knocked down by an older man. So here's a scene read by George Saunders where the family's just been to the police station, but the son couldn't identify the suspects.
The three of them sat there a bit in the ticking car. "I know I wasn't supposed to be downtown," Derek said. "I just wanted to try it." "Fair enough," Keith said. "Such a good dad. Reasonable man. Dear heart. Always fine with, well, everything. Even this, apparently. Fine with Derek breaking his promise. Fine with some random creep assaulting their kid and walking away scot-free." She felt, if she was being totally honest, that back at the station, Keith had, well, not failed them exactly. She wouldn't go that far, but hadn't there been a time back in the old days when Keith, the powerful man of the house, would have pulled aside the other powerful man, the cop, and between them, a deal would have been struck, and the two freaks would have been quietly let outside for a little talk, and oops, while out there, had the living shit beat out of them? Both of them? Just to be sure? Well, that wasn't the best. That wasn't, you know, fair or whatever. But geez, neither one of those losers was exactly hitting the ball out of the park. For the sake of argument, let's say that Keith and the cop, choosing to err slightly on the side of proactivity, had lightly, performatively roughed up those two dopes. The one who'd done it wouldn't do it again. The one who hadn't done it, well, if in the future he ever considered doing something out of line, which he probably would, given the life he was leading, he'd think twice. Net result, a safer Church Street, down which a nice kid like Derek could walk. Derek, in her mind, ambling down this old-timey Church Street, waved to an elderly couple drinking iced tea on their porch. "Go around back, lad. Use the tire swing on the old apple tree," the husband said. His wife was up there knitting. "You remind us of our own son, now a successful doctor," she said, then dropped her yarn ball, which rolled off the porch, and the old guy made a joke about his back as he hobbled down the stairs to fetch it. Good people, salt of the earth. But Church Street did not belong to them, or to Derek. It belonged to those two freaks who, because freaky, were somehow the most powerful players in the whole idiotic deal. Why were rejects running this show? Seriously, it was all backward because nobody wanted to hurt anybody's feelings. Nobody was willing to say what they really thought. Nobody cared enough to take a bold stand for what was right. And things kept spiraling downward. They walked to the porch through a pile of leaves, which was no fun. Not today. Today it was one more thing they had to do to get to the next not fun thing, which was dinner. This was real. This had happened. A guy had attacked her kid and suffered no consequences whatsoever and was probably off bragging about it to some other deadbeats around a campfire or whatnot. And what was she doing about it? Going inside to boil pasta.
The Mom of Bold Action is a new story by George Saunders. You can find it at newyorker.com. And you can hear Saunders read the whole thing on our podcast, The Writer's Voice. I'm Vincent Cunningham, and I'm going to turn things back over to David Remnick, because everybody knows, David, this is your thing, or one of your things. A writer comes on the program and talks to you about what they've been reading, or listening to, or watching.
Absolutely right, Vincent. It really is one of my favorite things. The other day, I talked to Rachel Syme, who writes for us about fashion and culture, and we talked about what she's been reading. And for Rachel lately, it's all about glamour and old-fashioned show business.
I always feel like books have a season that they tell you to read them in. And for me, summer is the season of the classic Hollywood memoir. Well, mostly because they're glamorous and full of champagne and spangles and Marabou, but also because, you know, in a time, especially in this early period of Hollywood, memoirs became this place where primarily women, actresses, could tell stories about misogyny, about racism, about on-set abuse that were not getting told in the mainstream.
What is the best one ever? What is the, you know, in spy novels, people say The Spy Who Came In From the Cold is like the model spy novel, or what is the very best celeb bio that you've ever read?
You know, I think I have to say for me, it might be Gloria Swanson's 1980 mega doorstopper memoir called Swanson on Swanson, which is 500 pages or so and covers basically the entire 20th century of entertainment. You know, she started in silent film and then had sort of a second life in Sunset Boulevard. And she was in love with Joseph Kennedy on the side. And so there's just political intrigue and the birth of Hollywood and parties at Hearst Castle. And she is so high on her own supply. I swear, this is just like such a I want to read you a little bit just to give you a sense of how much she loves herself. When she made Sunset Boulevard, her big assertion was that no other woman in Hollywood was brave enough to take on the role of Norma Desmond because it was a role of a has-been. And so she took on this role. Obviously, it was the role of a lifetime. She's incredible in it. Louis B. Mayer had a dinner party to show the movie to a lot of Hollywood insiders. And she said that it's so affected all of these older actresses that she had done this role. And she wrote, "People clustered around me and I had trouble moving up the aisle. Barbara Stanwyck fell on her knees and kissed the hem of my skirt. I could read it all in their eyes, a single message of elation. If she can do it, why should we be terrified? She's shown us that it can be done." I have never read anything. I read it when I was a teenager for the first time, and I feel like I had never read anything so self-aggrandizing and so self-mythologizing in my life that I was like, I didn't know you could do this, you know, that somebody could write this kind of buildings Roman for themselves.
Gloria Swanson on Gloria Swanson sounds fantastic. I you know, I read a lot of these music memoirs too, and I'm not a big theater guy, but the Moss Hart memoir, Act One, is pretty great.
Act One.
Yeah,
Act One. That's a wonderful, I think, you know, New York Broadway memoirs are their own category, which would be great for the summer as well. And yeah, that Act One is great. You know, Stephen Sondheim's Finishing the Hat. I mean, all these books that are about theater. I love backstage intrigue. I love anything that sort of tells you what's going on behind the cardboard and the papier-mâché. You know, I like anybody that peels back the curtain on showbiz. But the thing about celebrity memoirs that's always great is, like, as they're peeling back the curtain, they're putting another scrim up of, like, you know, obfuscation and elaboration and just basically saying that things happen that will never be fact-checked. And there's no fact-checking, by the way, on any book really still, but definitely not on classic Hollywood memoirs. I mean, they could be entirely fabricated.
We're probably a little grateful for that.
Absolutely.
What have you been reading lately that hits the mark for you?
Yeah, so another book that I think is really great for the summer, especially because it involves a summer activity, is Esther Williams' autobiography called Million Dollar Mermaid, which, for the people that don't know, she was sort of the inventor of the swimming picture. She was an Olympic-level athlete, a competitive swimmer, and she actually qualified for the Olympics, but she couldn't go because the year that she was supposed to go was 1940 to the Tokyo Games, and because of World War II, obviously those games never happened. So she changed tacks and she becomes this star of these crazy, trippy Technicolor swimming movies where Busby Berkeley's doing the choreography and all these women are jumping in a row. That move where all the women jumped one after the other, it's called the tiller because it resembles a plow.
Uh-huh.
She basically invented synchronized swimming. Waterproof mascara was basically invented for her. She had a fascinating life. She ended it by doing LSD with Cary Grant, but that's a whole other story. But she does go into it in the memoir. But
let's concentrate on the LSD with Cary Grant.
Well, Cary Grant told her to do it because he was like, if you're depressed, it will open your mind and change your life. And then she did it. And she was like, it did. And then I was really into it for a long time in the 60s. And it was, you know, self-medicating.
Esther Williams was an acid hit. That's
fantastic.
She was
microdose. I think she was closer to microdosing.
God
bless
her.
She was using it for depression. But yeah, I mean, she was an athlete. So it's almost like a sports memoir. You know, she's using her body in ways that are punishing. So there's this amazing scene in the book. It happens during the filming of her blockbuster 1950 picture, Million Dollar Mermaid. the title of her memoir as well. And for this film, she had to go on a 50-foot hydraulic lift and dive off. Well, here's what happened. While she's up there, she realizes she's wearing the absolute wrong costume to do this kind of high dive. She's wearing a chainmetal bathing suit thing and an aluminum crown, and she realizes that it's going to hit the water hard. She is being encouraged to dive off by Busby Berkeley and the director. They're all saying, jump, jump, jump. So she does, but in midair, and this is in her memoir, she literally says out loud to herself, oh shit, because she knows it's going to be a terrible landing. She hits the water with a thud. She breaks 6 vertebrae in her back, and then she doesn't work for 6 months.
Jeez.
She is just out of commission. And then, as soon as she's healed, pretty much right away, the studio asks her to get back into the suit and start again. So that's being a contract player in Hollywood in the 1950s.
Rachel, that is an amazing story. I mean, almost destroyed by the wrong swimsuit. Who else have you been reading?
Well, I have been revisiting the second memoir by the great cabaret singer, actress, dancer, kitten extraordinaire, Eartha Kitt, who, you know, wrote 3 memoirs, I believe, but the second one is called Alone with Me. And it was written in the 1970s. And it's notable for many reasons, but the thing that I love most about it is her acknowledgement section, which is kind of a burn book of everybody who has ever wronged her over the years, where she starts out, by the way, by thanking the CIA, which the year before her autobiography was published, it was revealed, had kept a dossier on her for years. And also she was being followed by them because she had said during a luncheon with Lady Bird Johnson that she was against the Vietnam War, which kind of blacklisted her. And the dossier basically said she was a woman of loose morals and not to be trusted. So in her autobiography, she opens it by saying, there are people in my life who have been more than incidental, but whom I found impossible to weave into the fabric of this work without digression, so I couldn't quit the book without at random throwing a few brickbats or bouquets to, the CIA, who has established my reputation with men who want to believe that I'm a nymphomaniac, but who should leave the writing of fiction to authors who don't write it at the taxpayer's expense.
Woohoo. Well done.
I mean, well done, wait, Eartha. Spicy opening. Spicy yeah. Opening.
And do they write them themselves? I mean, I'm an addict of books by a guy named David Ritz, who's an as-told-to person who's done all these books with Aretha Franklin and Marvin Gaye, B.B. King. And he's masterful at getting them to tell their stories in the way that you've never heard them before, but he's clearly shaping it and participating in this talent.
Sure. So I'd say 90% of celebrity memoirs are not written by the celebrities themselves. It's a lot of as told to. Gloria Swanson's memoir is an interesting story because her memoir was co-written with a man named Brian Degas, who was an art gallerist in New York, who sold the book to Random House without her consent. And then showed up at her door and said, you're going to work with me on this. And because she was 80 and ready to, like, cement her legacy, she was like, great.
Wow.
But that's a rare one. Usually they'll have a ghostwriter lined up. But then there are the memoirs that are undeniably written by the people themselves. And that's the last one I want to bring up with you today, which is, of course, the wonderful and amazing Carrie Fisher, who I reread Wishful Drinking this year, which is a kind of extension of the one-woman show that she did. She was a brilliant writer in addition to an actress, but that's my favorite of her memoirs, Wishful Drinking, because it gets so deeply into her background as a Hollywood, part of a Hollywood dynasty, I would say, but also a Hollywood dropout, a Hollywood resistor, somebody who's tied to it for the rest of her life, no matter how hard she tried to get away. I love that book because it's so raw and honest about Hollywood and how it messes you up.
Rachel, is there a moment in Carrie Fisher's books that really stands out to you?
In the chapter about Star Wars, she is explaining that George Lucas wouldn't let her wear a bra because his theory about space was that in zero gravity, your body will expand, so you couldn't wear underwear or something crazy.
Oh, okay, time out. So he had a space underwear theory?
Yes, he was like a bra wouldn't work, an underwire wouldn't work in space because when you're in space, your body expands and whatever. It left her braless.
Whatever, indeed. Jesus.
So she had this whole funny theory about, he was like, your bra would strangle you in space. That's basically what he told her. And so she wrote in her memoir, one of the greatest sentences I think written, and especially poignant given that, you know, she passed away. She wrote, I think this would make a fantastic obit. So I tell my younger friends that no matter how I go, I want it reported that I drowned in moonlight, strangled by my own bra. So if someone has a sense of humor about being famous, it's definitely her.
Well, these books sound like a great way to finish an arduous summer season in many ways. Rachel, thank you so much.
Thank you, David.
Rachel Syme, who writes about style and culture for The New Yorker, and she's published a big piece about celebrity memoirs on our website with audio and images and readings of some of those favorite books. It's a lot of fun, and you can find it at newyorker.com. That's it for me today. Thanks to my colleague and friend, Vincent Cunningham. Hope the rest of the summer, what little is left of it, treats you well. See you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino.
With additional help this week from Aaron Hankin at WYPR.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.